Epstein Reel 8?
In October 1990, the village of Kippenheim invited all the survivors to come back for a reunion. And I went back. Before I went back, and by the way, I was accompanied by my son part of the time, not the entire time. But before we went back to Kippenheim, we went to France and visited two camps that I had not previously visited. The camp where my father was in Les Mills. And before I went to Les Mills, I learned that Leon Furstmeier, a German Jewish writer, had been interned in Les Mills right after the war started. And in his book, The Devil in France, the first 80 or so pages, he describes the conditions in Les Mills. And I read that before I left. And when I came to Les Mills, it was like a place that I had been to because he describes it so vividly. And from his description, I know exactly where my father was within the camp. Because he talked about where these people who came. And so he was probably there at the same time when my father was there. And I remember my father wrote in some of the letters about some of the things that were, that the these cultural activities that were going on there and that he participated in, either as passively as a receiver, or sometimes he also gave lectures. For instance, he lectured on photography without cameras. And the other camp that we visited was Poncy, which is near Paris, which was this transit camp where all the Jews from France, who, whether they were in camps or caught in the streets, were sent there, stayed there for a few days, and then went on, were sent on to their extermination. And my parents, according to this 1956 letter I have, were there at different times. After that, my son and I went to Germany and went to Kippenheim. And I purposely arranged it so that we would get there before all the activities started and all the people arrived. Because I wanted to do some of the things that my parents and I did together. Like we used to hike in the woods together. On Sunday mornings, if my parents, if we didn't do something jointly, my father and I, on Sunday mornings, would take a hike into the nearby woods. And every week, every Sunday, I would be given a topic to discuss the following week. And I would have to do some reading or thinking about it so that I could discuss it the next week. And I wanted to retrace some of those steps and with my son. And so we did some of that, although part of the woods is gone and there are now vineyards, which totally disoriented me when I didn't know where I was, because these vineyards go on forever. I had never been able to, or never had wanted to go back inside the house where I lived. I made that as a conscious decision the two times that I was there, 1947 and 1970, and had no intention to go back this time. And the last day that my son was there, he said, "Don't you want to go in the house?" And I said, "If you, no." I said, "But if you want to go in, I don't ring the doorbell and arrange it." And he said, "Well, you know, my camera's better than yours. And if you want some pictures, I could take some pictures before I leave today." I said, "Okay." And I rang the doorbell and this woman opened up the door. And the first thing that I saw was this magnificent inner staircase, looking more beautiful than I remembered it, because it was really well maintained. It looked like it had just been really stayed. And the house has been, in outside as well as inside, has been really renovated or modernized. But when I went into the bedroom, which was used to be their bedroom used to be my parents' bedroom, the same light fixture was still there. And then, in the course of our visit there, you know, I encountered, of course, lots of people that I knew, and some of the kids that I mean, now adults, but that I went to grade school with, and had some of the things confirmed, that, you know, the feeling that I had that we were different was confirmed, because some of the, you know, you and your parents were always different. Your parents used to go to concerts when it was still permitted. Your parents always had books. Children that came to the house and played with me, you know, said, I remember there was always music in your house. Your mother would play the piano, or your father the violin, or you had the record player on, or the radio was on to music. And you had toys like nobody else had toys. And I said, probably today you would call them educational toys. So that sort of confirmed what I really knew, but it was nice to have it confirmed, because I sometimes wondered, what I remember, is it really so, or did I create it because I wanted to be that way? When I was there, everybody was very warm, and I really felt loved and wanted and welcomed, and I had a very good feeling, and I felt very positive when I left, with one exception. There were some asylum seekers live in the village, and there's a lot of negative feeling about these people and about the man who was housing them. And the last night that we were there, there was a gathering and speeches and so on. And when the mayor was through speaking, I went over to him and I said, I would really like to say some things that are on my mind that I don't want to leave without saying, is it possible? He said, sure. And so he called on me, and I thanked everybody, you know, expressed my appreciation for everything that I experienced that week, and that I'm going away with some very positive feelings. However, it has bothered me to have heard these negative feelings about the asylum seekers. And I said, you know, at one time, those of us who are here today whom you've invited back, and I have heard from some people that they were bothered by how much money was spent on us. I said, at one point, we were almost in the position of the asylum seekers. We were not wanted. And look how much money and effort and time you've had to spend to bring us back. And think about it, and your feelings about these asylum seekers. Maybe someday you're going to have to bring them back. Maybe now is the time to do the right thing and to welcome them. Because they're not here because they want to be here and create problems. They're here because wherever they're coming from, there are problems. And that's why they're here, to seeking asylum, seeking your help, your receptivity. And I said, but I don't want to leave on a negative tone. I said, but let's all join hands in friendship. And then after I left up there, I went to Hanau, where my grandfather and where my mother came from, the city that my grandfather had to leave. And I visited the cemetery there and found my grandmother's grave there. And I also found my grandparents' home, which had been badly bombed but was restored almost the way it was before. And I wanted to go in and see the place. It's now the office of a psychiatrist or a psychologist. And the man opened the door and didn't want to let me in. And I explained to him why I'm there and that I'm only here today and why it's important for me to be there. It's gave him the whole background. And he said, these are offices and you can't come in here. And I'm thinking, this man is a psychologist. He's trying to help. But I did something, and I did it almost, I did it not intentionally, but it worked. And I all of a sudden realized what I was doing and that it was working. I moved closer to him. And as I moved closer to him, he backed up. And I just moved still closer to him. And very soon, I was inside. And then once I was inside, he showed me a room. And then I thanked him. And as I walked out, and I started to take photographs from the outside, I was approached by a man who wanted to know why I'm taking pictures and who am I. And so I explained to him who I was. And he said, when your grandfather had to sell the house, he sold it to my father. My father is dead, and I now live in this house. I live on the second floor. And he started to tell me a lot of things about that happened at that time that I didn't know, sort of filled me in. And then from there, I went to Cologne because I had been told that in a library in Cologne, there's lots of information about German Jews and former German Jewish community. And since I was interested in, my daughter-in-law and I are interested in genealogy, I thought maybe there's some things that I can find out. Well, the information that I was looking for wasn't there. And so I didn't spend much time in that library, although I had a lot of 3 days to be spent there. And that's when I then contacted my friend Beller, which I talked about earlier. And while I was in Cologne, I contacted a German peace organization who had contacted me about a year before and had asked me to come and speak about my experiences as a Holocaust survivor in Germany to different organizations in January and February, or February of 1991. But I hadn't heard any more from them, and so I thought, since I'm in Cologne and this organization is here, I might as well stop in. And they said, well, the reason you haven't heard further is because we don't know what's happening with the situation in the Middle East right now and with Iraq. And I think it might be better if we postpone this until the summer. And we may not even be able to do it then. So how about if we plan this for June? And so it was planned for June. But after meeting my friend Bella in November for that one day, and corresponding for a while, we decided that I would come over there. And in January and most of February, I was over there. And during that, well, before I left here in St. Louis, and shortly after Iraq invaded Kuwait, a peace forum was founded, and we were objecting to what our government was doing from the very beginning, and increasingly more so as we sent more and more troops over there. And by the time shortly after I got to Germany, war broke out. And there was an active peace movement in the community there. And there were daily vigils, and I participated in the daily vigils. There was a big gathering in Bonn on January 26th. At the same time as on January 26th, there was a big gathering in Washington, D.C. in opposition to this war. I participated in that. I wore a big sign at all times when I was at these vigils or gatherings saying, as an American, in German, saying, as an American citizen, I'm opposed to this war and the consequences, and talked about the consequences of this war. I publicly spoke, addressed people at these public vigils on several occasions. I frequently heard some Germans say that they really shouldn't oppose, Germans shouldn't oppose this war because it will seem to be anti-American. Every Germans must remember what America has done for Germany. And so we got into long discussions about that. But all over Germany, and as I was leaving to come back to the United States, I was on the train from Cologne to Frankfurt, where I caught the plane. Along the train, I saw in the windows signs against the war, some of them just saying nein or no. When I came to St. Louis, I took a taxi from the airport, and it went all the way from the airport to my house. I saw nothing in opposition to the war, which really troubled me. It wasn't until I got to my own house, where I had left a sign before I left in my window in opposition to the war. That was the first thing that I saw that was in opposition to the war. The only other things that I saw were yellow ribbons and American flags everywhere, with a great proliferation of it, which deeply troubled me. Because we should not have this, what we did was just all wrong. The war is not over. We're talking as though it were over. It is not over. Thousands of people, children, innocent children, are dying because there is no medicine. The hospitals have no medicine. There's no sanitation because we bumped all the supporter systems. We bumped the electric, the power systems. It's not over. And you know, we're the killers. And as a pacifist or a peace-loving person, this deeply troubles me, shames me. It shames me also what is going on in the Middle East, in Israel, vis-a-vis the Palestinians. Very often, unfortunately, people don't see the difference between Israel or Israelis and Jews, or the Israeli government and Jews. And I find myself being in a defensive position saying, I'm not like that, and it's not comfortable to be in that kind of position. But for lack of anything better, that's what I need to do to explain myself. And I'm involved in an organization called New Jewish Agenda, which is a progressive political organization, and has since its inception, I think it came into existence about 1980, been for a two-state solution. That's the only way to bring about peace in that area.
Talking of your German trip, your most recent one, did you notice any signs of anti-Semitism and really signs of a resurgence of fascism?
I didn't observe it firsthand, but I read about it, heard about it, and continue to hear about it because I'm still in touch with people that I met on this speaking tour. And so periodically I've sent leaflets that Nazi groups over there are giving out. In fact, I wrote to one Nazi group and using my German name and giving my work address, because I did not want to give my, being paranoid enough, not wanting to give my home address, and asked to be put on their mailing list and asked for some of their literature, but I never got a response. I have, to date, I've received nothing, and I think I wrote at least 3 months ago, so I doubt that I will get anything. Maybe the organization has disbanded, but that's wishful thinking, I think, on my part. And, you know, I think a lot of it, perhaps, there were quote-unquote neo-Nazis in West Germany all along. But since the wall is down, in East Germany there's been a real resurgence of fascism. And I think it's because a lot of people are, particularly young people, are loose ends. There's no one telling them specifically what to do and how to do, but then came along some fascists, some Nazis, and have lured them and given them a reason for existence, given them something to work towards. And that has spread now, not also into West Germany. And it's not only in Germany, it is happening in this country also. And with given the economic conditions in this country, which are very bad, given what's happening in Russia right now, which is very frightening, you know, all you need is some fanatical person like a Hitler to come along, and I'm sure they exist. And who knows what's going to happen. It's really frightening me. I think these are the worst of times, for the worst of times that I've known for a long, long time. Really frightening times. And I'm less fearful for myself because I'm getting on in age, but I have grandchildren. And it's not only my grandchildren, I mean, there are young people all over the world, and that's ahead for them.
I wonder how you relate this, you know, to your own history and, you know, what happened to your parents. Could you have believed that this would have happened again after the Second World War?
After the Second World War, I didn't think so. I thought, really, you know, I think the First World War was the war to end all wars, or it was called that. But I really thought after World War II, many lessons have been learned by many people, and we're going to all be vigilant, and we're never going to let this happen again. And those of us who've suffered, who've learned what it is, are really going to be actively involved in letting others know what can happen if one doesn't stand up. And it didn't go that way. And this particularly troubles me when I talk to Holocaust survivors who we all remember, and there isn't a day that I don't remember. Isn't a day that I don't think about my parents. But most of, or many of the Holocaust survivors that I have encountered, it's only remembering and only the past. And but remembering to me also has to have a present and a future perspective. And that seems to be lacking for them. And they only think in terms of, is this good for Jews? And if it isn't good for Jews, we got to do something about it. They never think of, is this good for humanity? They don't know and don't want to know, and if you tell them, they still don't want to know and don't care if it involves people who are not Jewish. And I don't think, you know, I'm reminded of Pastor Niemöller's saying, and he said, you know, first they came for the trade unionists, and I wasn't a trade unionist, and so I said nothing and did nothing. And then they came for the Catholics, and I wasn't Catholic, and I did nothing. And they came for the Jews, and I wasn't Jewish, and I did nothing. And then they finally came for me, and then there was nobody here to do anything, or to say anything anymore. And, you know, that's an important lesson, really, to be learned. And I feel I owe it to those who aren't here anymore to be involved. Not that I can change the world, but I firmly believe that each and every one of us can and must do whatever it is possible to do, no matter how minuscule it is, and that each and every one of us does indeed make a difference. We may never know what that difference is, but we do make a difference, and must make a difference.
Well, Hedy, thank you very much indeed for telling me about your experience and your reflections on it. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.